Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name's Patrick Gray, and on this week's show, we've got two co-hosts for you. Adam Boileau is joining us, and so is our so-called fifth beetle, our CrowdStrike co-founder turned policy think tank guy, Dmitry Alperovich, and we'll be chatting about all the week's news with both of them in just a moment. This week's show is brought to you by Rumble, the network discovery tool founded by HD Moore, or the asset discovery tool founded by HD Moore. And this week we are talking to HD about what he and his team did through the whole Log4j drama. There's been a lot said about Log4j, but this is an interview that I personally thought was quite interesting because what Rumble was able to do was, you know, as an asset discovery tool, was probably more useful in that whole situation than what a lot of vuln scanners were doing. So that's one thing, but you know, there's a big takeaway from this interview, and that's that you can actually just grab a free trial copy of Rumble without any interaction with sales, and you can scan up to 50,000 assets for Log4j issues pretty quickly and easily. So yeah, I would recommend that you do that. And if you need to hit more than 50K assets in your trial, you can just contact them. And in my mind, this is totally worth doing because Rumble is going to find all your unmanaged crap that is stuffed with the bad Java. Anyway, that interview with HD Moore is coming up after this week's news section, which starts now. And of course, we're joined by Adam Boileau and Dmitry Alperovich, and you would have heard me refer to Dmitry as the Risky Business Fifth Beetle. And that's basically because since he left CrowdStrike and founded the Silverado Policy Accelerator, his interests and ours align pretty tightly. So, you know, Dmitry's in our staff Slack. He even proofreads our newsletter and provides feedback before it goes out every Thursday, that sort of thing. And yeah, we usually do a few of these double co-host editions every January, so we thought we'd wheel him out for this one. Welcome, Dmitry and Adam.
Thanks for having me. Just don't expect me to sing.
Yeah, hey, it's good to be back after a week off.
Excellent. Now, it's kind of funny because we scheduled this recording with Dmitry a little while ago, and you know, Russia stuff is a big interest of yours, Dmitry, and we're chock full of it this week. Just complete coincidence. But let's start off with the arrest in Russia of, I think it was 25 suspects tied to the Reval ransomware crew. It's interesting because depending on who you talk to, either the FSB has shut down and dismantled Reval completely or just arrested a few money mules, right? Like, everybody seems to have an opinion on this. So Dmitry, let's start with you. What do you make of these arrests in Russia of the Reval ransomware crew?
Well, look, on the positive side, this is exactly what the type of action that we've been looking for, right? We've been demanding since at least Colonial, if not before, for Russia to take action. And now they have. So that's the good news. Of course, the problem is that the timing of this just really stinks. The fact that they waited 6 months, despite persistent requests from the U.S. government, including provision of names of individuals we wanted to see arrested, and now when they're about to invade Ukraine and there are severe sanctions being threatened against them, they decide to arrest this crew. I think this is ransomware diplomacy, as I called it on Twitter. They're trying to send a signal, hey, we can help you on ransomware, but don't you dare sanction us because we can easily let these guys go.
I mean, I feel like, you know, this is in the context of when you're talking about, like, you know, invasions and war, you know, this feels like pretty small beer. But I do wonder if they've done this in order to say, hey, look, we're a nation of laws, right? Like, did you get that vibe, Adam?
Yeah, the timing is certainly a bit sus, and you know, the Reval crew in particular has been pretty quiet lately. I mean, since the Colonial and JBS,
yeah, basically they haven't done shit since October, right? And now they get arrested.
Yes. Yeah, and you know, we also don't really know the status of the people who've been arrested in terms of, you know, kind of like where they were in the organizational structure, how important they are, how much of a big deal it is, whether they're just being, you know, kind of drafted for other use. Who knows? You know, things in Russia are always so kind of opaque and I mean, perhaps Dmitry has better insights, but to us it just feels confusing the whole time, and maybe that's the game. Like, they, you know, Putin is a big fan of just confusing us.
Well, this is actually something that Dmitry and I have argued about over the last week, because this is what I thought, right? Which is, Putin loves confusing people, and he's like, and Dmitry's opinion is that, you know, if you look at what they do, it's usually pretty rational and strategic. But I think, you know, on the global stage, that might be true, Dmitry, but you can't, with a straight face, argue that Putin doesn't love to, you know, muddy the waters a little bit, you know, and just do stuff occasionally that's, you know, the motivation behind doing it is just to waste people's analytical capacity trying to figure out what it means.
Look, he loves trolling. Who doesn't? But he does try to accomplish things. And look, if you want to look for a positive here, I do think that we might see a little bit of less of ransomware activity in the very near future. I'm talking about maybe a week or two before he decides to invade. And I saw even interesting speculation from Group IB saying that they think that Russian hackers may start targeting Russian companies now because they think that American companies may be off limits. Again, I don't think that this will last. And as soon as he invades, everything is going to be fair game. But, you know, maybe we can enjoy a little bit of quiet for at least a week or two.
So you think maybe a few might pull their heads in after this?
Yeah, I think so. I think they'll wait to see for the dust to settle and what this really means. Remember, a lot of these guys may start talking if they're in FSB custody. FSB is not known for its hands-off interrogation approach. So a lot of people are probably shaking their boots right now about who else might get picked up and arrested.
It's funny, actually, because last week we ran a guest post in our newsletter from Daniel Gordon, who's a CTI guy, who was basically making a very strong case that Russian ransomware has become a very big problem in China as well. And then, of course, you know, we see these arrests. And the argument in the piece was that China was probably going to use its diplomatic pressure to try to get Russia to act on these guys. And yeah, Daniel actually sent me a tweet with a link, you know, to the arrest report going, wow, that was quick, which was quite funny. But yeah, you never know. Maybe it was Xi Jinping gave him a call and said, Reval are causing us trouble.
Although the FSB did give credit to U.S. government, so I doubt that.
Oh, yeah, they gave credit, Dmitry, and it was faint praise. And I love this. It's my favorite quote from the whole thing. The FSB said its investigation was prompted by, and quote, the appeal of the competent U.S. authorities.
you know what this means, though, is that if there is an invasion and severe sanctions are placed upon Russia, they can now blame the Americans when they let these guys go, saying that the Americans misled them and they got them to arrest perfectly innocent Russian guys that had nothing to do with ransomware.
Well, you never know. Let's see how it plays out. But meanwhile, a crew, looks like affiliates, got arrested in Ukraine. Catalin Kimpanu has the write-up for the Record. We've seen a lot of action from the Ukrainians against ransomware affiliates in their territory. And Europol has taken down a service called VPN Lab, which is one of those VPNs that's marketed heavily on underground forums. You do wonder if they seized it a while ago and they've been collecting some telemetry since. And is there any indication that that's been the case?
Well, not quite sure, but it could be part of a campaign. We saw DoubleVPN being taken down in June. You know, I just have to say that this is one of the most underappreciated parts of law enforcement takedowns that can actually have an effect. Going after the infrastructure that the bad guys use. Some of your listeners may remember the McCullough takedown done by our friend Brian Krebs, of all people, who basically got McCullough to disconnect from the upstream providers. And overnight, 95% of the spam was gone. Now, it didn't last, of course, but for at least a few weeks, people breathed easier as email spam went way down. So going after these places that the criminals love to use, like VPN services and other infrastructure services, can have a really big impact.
Yeah, well, I've noticed that as well. And like targeting things like Bitcoin tumblers, like it's all eminently sensible. But Adam, I got a question for you, which is why are these people using VPNs and not Tor and not like owned boxes as jump points? Like this just doesn't make any sense.
I mean, I figure they probably are using all of those things, right? A bit of Tor, a bunch of owned boxes. But in the end, you do need to start somewhere. And a VPN service is a good place for kind of first hop out of your environment. You don't necessarily want to go straight into Tor from your place. You don't necessarily want to go straight into an owned box. So a commercial VPN is a good first step. And one of the things I thought was interesting about this one is it's been around for a long time. This is a VPN service that's been running since 2008. And so when you go after a place that has that kind of longevity, it has higher trust than one of the newer ones. And, you know, obviously sitting on it, sniffing some traffic, looking at the customer records would be a useful thing to do. And especially going back that far where perhaps the OPSEC concerns were a little different, you know, the way that you were thinking was a little different. And once you've got a VPN provider you trust, you're probably not going to move. So, you know, if you can sit there for a long time or you get access to business records, then, yeah, you've definitely got some good options there versus a more modern, you know, newer environment that perhaps has thought about, you know, modern threat modeling for criminals.
And also Tor is just so slow. Like it's so painful, yes, to use. So it's not an accident that they want to use a VPN.
Yeah, I guess if you're trying to do exfil via a Tor node, right? Like if you've just
you know, you're moving into ransomware someone and do data extortion and you want to download, you know, a few gig, that's not going to be fun.
It's a very tedious day at the office.
Yeah, you're going to use VPN Lab and maybe you're going to get a knock on the door. So good news, good news all around. This one is a Sign of the Times piece. It's from Andrea Peterson over at The Record. Schools in Albuquerque are now having what they're calling cybersecurity snow days, right? When they get ransomware, it's like, you know, the old snow day where the kids get to stay home. Yeah, the reason I included this one is because it is just such a depressing sign that schools getting regularly rinsed by ransomware operators has become a kind of new normal.
Totally new reality. But, you know, it poses one great question of, are schools critical infrastructure? They're traditionally not defined as one by U.S. government, but you see things like that and the impact that it can have on kids, and it really makes you question whether we're making the right decisions about how we define critical infrastructure.
Yeah, maybe they need to change the name of the school to like ExxonMobil Elementary or something. Adam, what did you think of this?
The thing I liked about this was, we don't have, I guess, the weather that warrants snow days here in New Zealand quite so much, but the fact that for like an actual weather snow day, they build it into the schedule. So it's kind of like a plan, like it's going to snow a number of days a year. We'll just plan that and kids will, you know, we've taken that into account in the year. And the idea that you would do the same for ransomware is just like, look, we're going to be out because the computers are ruined by Russian criminals 5 days a year. Let's just extend the school year by a week. Easy. That's the sign of the times, but for me.
this is not the cyberpunk future we were looking for, I think.
Although I bet that they'll get a lot of volunteers now among school children to help secure their networks.
I'd be careful doing that based on my experience with some of my schoolmates. But anyway, now look, obviously a big part of the news this week is that a bunch of government agencies in Ukraine got hit with wiper attacks. And also a bunch of government agencies, and there's a big overlap in these targets, got hit with defacements. Looks like two different crews, open question on coordination. There's been a bunch of coverage on this, but I really think Kim Zetter has nailed the coverage on her Substack, because she's taken a more comprehensive approach rather than just writing bite-sized pieces about this. So I've linked through to two of her write-ups in this week's show notes. Dimitri, I want to get your thoughts on this, right? Because obviously you're following the Ukraine situation very closely. What do we know about these attacks? A lot of people are saying that, you know, Belarus was involved, and other people are saying, oh, it's Russian state actors, and there's a lot to get through here. So what do you make of all of this?
Well, first of all, we don't know much. In terms of the wiper attack that Microsoft disclosed a few days ago, they could not attribute it to any group because there was no overlapping code whatsoever between that code and any other code that they've seen previously. With the defacements themselves, there's not enough data to really attribute that one either. So a lot of people are speculating about whether this is tied to Ghostwriter, this group that has some questionable attribution. People are not sure if it's Russia or Belarus. But the bottom line is we actually don't have any attribution on any of these attacks. Obviously, a lot of suspicions pointing at Russia, given what's going on, but really not a lot of information.
Well, I mean, you know, you don't need much to sort of draw a basic inference there, do you, right? Like, Russia looks like it's going to invade Ukraine and all of a sudden Ukraine's having computer trouble. Like, it's not drawing a very long bow.
No, certainly not. And could be part of a PSYOPs campaign that the Russians are planning. But such as it is, it wasn't very effective. The Ukrainians have certainly suffered major cyber attacks in the last 7-8 years that were way more consequential than this one. Certainly the power outages in 2015 and 2016, not Petya and the rest of it.
Yeah. So, I mean, one thing that I think it was ESET who spotted this is, I think it was the wiper malware was being obfuscated using a crime tool, which a lot of people are saying it's the first time we can say an APT is doing this. It was the wiper stuff, right?
It was. And it was interesting because they actually used an online obfuscator tool. So they had to submit their malware to this online service to get it obfuscated, which is pretty unusual for, you know, if you think about nation state organizations, they don't really want to share their malware before they deploy them for quite obvious reasons. So that was a really interesting revelation from ESET.
I mean, I get that people are pointing to it and saying it's novel, but Adam and I, you know, having talked about this stuff over so many years, Adam, do you remember we spoke about one who got snapped because they kept submitting their samples to VirusTotal?
Yes. Yeah. And it's always, you know, when you read a story like this, because the thing that stood out to me was, you know, it seems clumsy and you want to say, hey, look, this is in the context of a big geopolitical situation, therefore it's sophisticated nation state. But then the actual, like the defacements, for example, was like 70 sites defaced. And if you read that on a, you know, the bare headline sounds, you know, operationally advanced. But then it turns out like 50 of them are managed by one company. They all share the same CMS, or most of them share the same CMS. You can see how one bug or one supply chain intrusion, and I think the company Kitsoft that managed 50 of the 70 sites also said that they had had the wiper in there, which, you know, kind of suggests some coordination. But then the defacements were like, oh, all of your data has been destroyed, but then the wiper hadn't triggered, and that felt like poorly coordinated. And so the idea that you would use an online obfuscator, and you've got clearly a couple of groups, you know, trying to, you know, maybe a couple of people, a couple of teams, whatever it is, you know, trying to coordinate their activity, kind of messing it up, you know, seems pretty amateur hour.
I mean, maybe it's their graduate teams, right?
Like, well, yeah, exactly. Maybe they're scaling up, right? They're getting some new people in, you know, training them up. I mean, certainly when I saw the first talk of, you know, maybe it was Belarus, you know, trying to help a brother out, and they hadn't really, you know, brought the A-team to the game and are now kind of made a mess of it like that, you know, that seemed like a thing that, you know, was plausible to me. But yeah, we often think of these crews as very sophisticated, and you don't have to be to do this kind of stuff. And Dimitri's very right. Of course, we have seen much better orchestrated attacks in Ukraine and than this one. But yeah, still the headlines do make it look pretty serious, and the context is still serious.
Yeah, I think the initial reports, just going back to something you were talking about there, the initial report suggested that this might have, the defacements might have occurred because there was an unpatched bug in the CMS software. But yeah, it really does look like it's their, you know, their CMS maintenance company or whatever that got popped, right? And that's what led to this. So yeah, I mean, it all seems a bit piss weak, you know, if I'm going to be honest, right? If you're trying to be big and scary, like defacing a few websites. Dimitri, why bother doing this? I'm serious. Like, I don't get it.
Well, I think they are trying to create sort of a psychological frame of mind for the Ukrainians that they're besieged, that they're being attacked from all sides, that everything is hopeless and no one's going to come to help them. But frankly, the Ukrainians are way more resilient given what they've already experienced in the last 8 years. So we'll see if they escalate, along obviously with the kinetic action that may take place. But for now, this is not the best that you can expect from the Russians.
Yeah, yeah. Well, let's hope we don't see better stuff, right?
The Polish angle of like including Poland in the defacements, that kind of played into the making them feel besieged, because obviously there's been some historical, you know, grief between Ukraine and Poland. So that was, you know, kind of plays into that angle, but did also seem very clumsy. And I think some actual Pole, you know, native Polish speakers are like, this has just been Google translated. This is bullshit.
Pretty
clumsy.
The idea that an intel service can't find a good Polish speaker, I've always just been puzzled by that. We saw that obviously with Guccifer, where they were trying to translate Romanian with Google Translate. It makes you shake your hand.
Yeah, you got to get a native experience speaker who also passes the clearance checks. I've always thought that's probably why. And it could be something that boring, but anyway. Moving on, and the White House hosted its big powwow, you know, to solve this whole supply chain and open source thing. This is in the wake of the Log4j bug. Look, I've seen a lot of people throwing shade at this meeting being convened, right? And they brought in people from like the Apache Software Foundation, from the Linux Foundation, Apple, Facebook, Google, you know, which are obviously big users of open source software. I mean, I think maybe they're not quite the right targets when we're doing this in the wake of a Java floor. I would have thought you'd get the CISO from like Bank of America and similar companies like that together. But I think the shade is misdirected, because when it comes to stuff like this, you got to start somewhere. Now, Dimitri, you work in the policy world these days and you're based in DC. What did you make of this meeting? What are your thoughts on this meeting?
Well, we haven't really had a detailed readout, and the key will be what actions are taken after this meeting, of course. But I thought that one of the most interesting things that came out of this was not something that came out of the White House, but something that the Apache Software Foundation released right before the summit, which was their paper highlighting really one of the biggest challenges they face is end-of-life issues for their software. That, you know, once a developer decides to kill the project, that project is still used for many years by lots and lots of different people, and no one is going to be patching it, no matter how many vulnerabilities get submitted. And it does remind me of the keynote from Usenix a few years ago by my good friend Alex Ionescu, who actually just joined CSEC in Canada, but he gave a keynote that we don't need more bug hunters, we need more fixers. And that's one of the fundamental issues we have in cybersecurity, is not enough developers that are actually fixing all these bugs.
Yeah, you do wonder how you'd incentivize that sort of thing. Maybe we need a companion company for, you know, the likes of Bug Crowd, which, I don't know, Fix Crowd. What do you think, Adam?
Well, I mean, that's the group of people in this meeting are most of the people who pay for open source software, right, rather than necessarily develop it. And so, you know, that plays into this idea that we need, you know, better quality maintenance and, yeah, some way to fund it. We see, you know, Google and some of the other organizations, you know, funding, you know, not only bug bounties, but also fixed bounties, right? I mean, saying this particular feature, you know, needs to be worked on, providing a, you know, bounty for someone to do that, you know, whether it's feature development or whether it is, you know, a bug fixing or some kind of audit, you know, or fixing the results of an audit. So, you know, that group of people is in the right place to do that sort of thing. And I mean, throwing money at open source is always a bit of a strange incentivization. It isn't the natural fit. I mean, open source software and open source developers tend to be motivated by things other than money. Money's important, but it's not the primary thing. And I think, you know, trying to solve this problem with just money, just, you know, bounties, that kind of thing, does not always consider the community that comes from.
Of course, and we have solved some pretty glaring open source problems in the past. If you look at when bugs started shaking out of OpenSSL and stuff like that, right? Like the big companies that rely on that tech, they moved, they provided funding, they provided expertise, and we wound up with much better tech as a result of that. I think where it gets complicated is when we're talking about it from a supply chain perspective. Like look at something like Log4j, which was such a vital piece of the Java ecosystem, and most people had never heard of it before, right? So while it's great that companies like Amazon and Google will get together and, you know, put some brain power towards fixing bugs in Apache and trying to make, you know, these core building blocks of our infrastructure more secure, I think this challenge is different because really where it's got to start is you've actually got to take a more nuanced look at what the software supply chain looks like and start figuring out where these efforts need to be prioritized. And I guess my point when it came to the Java stuff is, you know, I can't really imagine that this is going to be something of core criticality to a company like Amazon, right? It's much more enterprise-consumed software.
Yeah, no, I agree completely. And the challenge, of course, the distinction you make between something big like OpenSSL or Apache, where you have one, you know, kind of monolithic component that's super important, the current model has kind of addressed those pretty well. And then now we're comparing against very large ecosystems of developer-built components, you know, like the NPM world for JavaScript, or, you know, the CPAN Perl libraries, or this kind of thing for Java, where there's just, you know, hundreds of thousands of little packages that developers use that we don't think about. And that model doesn't really work so well for those. And I think one of the things that has made a difference is kind of like the work that GitHub's been doing, right? Doing very large-scale analysis of software stored on their platform, helping developers, you know, learn about vulnerabilities in their software, in their supply chain, doing that kind of analysis. That stuff's helpful. And so it's very good to see Microsoft there. And I would certainly hope that there were some, you know, GitHub people involved in the Microsoft delegation, because that's one of the platforms that really is in a great position to make an excellent difference to that, you know, software supply chain, open source miasma.
I think one of the problems we face here is that people are just not paying enough money to fix these problems. So it's great when Google gives grants or Facebook or others, but the reality is that it's cheaper than ever to start a company nowadays and build it into a multi-billion dollar company, in part because you can rely on open source and basically leech off other people's work. And I think maybe we should start considering changes to some of these open source licenses, where if you're making boatloads of money, if you build a multi-billion dollar company, maybe you should be forced to pay back some license fees that would pay for ongoing security maintenance of the software that you're using.
There we go. We've got a tech entrepreneur Marxist in our midst. And yeah, look, speaking of repos, as Adam just was, you know, and we don't even need to talk about this, but I guess I wanted to highlight it this week because, yeah, we're talking about meetings at the White House involving Apache and this and that. And then, you know, we've got a story here from the Daily Swig, which is about a couple of high-impact vulnerabilities in GitLab, right? And this is the sort of stuff where a bug in GitLab can be leveraged to create bugs in all sorts of other places, right? So that's just something I wanted to introduce. Is this is a big problem. It's hard to get your head around.
Yeah, it really is. And stuff like GitLab and other CI/CD and software dev bits of, you know, of plumbing are just, you know, they get you all sorts of places if you're willing to go use them that way. And, you know, GitLab in particular, you know, you got to be patching it like every week. And that's hard work. And I suspect that most people who have GitLab on the internet don't even realize that it's quite as buggy as it is.
Yeah. In particular, I know you've got a good friend. You've got a good friend who manages a bunch of GitLab, right? Which is why every time you're talking about this, you're just like, it's the vicarious. You've lived the vicarious hell through this friend.
Yeah. Like literally yesterday morning patch window for GitLab. So yeah.
The interesting thing here is that going after a source code repository is as old of a hack as we've had in a long, long time. In fact, the Operation Aurora hack of Google back and others back in 2010, one of the sort of stories that people didn't pay quite as close attention to is that they went after Perforce, the version control software that's used by many of the victims, and tried to steal source code from there. And there was a lot of concern that they potentially modified it as well. So if you're trying to inject backdoors, you know, one way to do that is through the build servers, as we saw with SolarWinds. But another way, of course, is the traditional route, which is the software repository.
Now, this one, obviously, we need to get your thoughts, Dimitri, because it's a story appearing on The Record written by Martin Matyshak, and it's actually based on some comments from some participants in a Silverado Policy Accelerator event. And the gist of the story is that the cyber incident reporting legislation that wound up getting knifed, that didn't pass through the various bits of, you know, US lawmaking that it needed to become law, it looks like there's still a push on to get it done eventually. That's the upshot here, right?
That's right. We had an event last week with two members of Congress, a Democrat and a Republican, and DHS representatives and FBI representatives talking about this and other issues. And the upshot here is exactly that there is bipartisan agreement on this bill. It's basically locked and loaded. And they literally just ran out of a few hours of time to get it passed and into what's known as the Defense Authorization Bill, which funds the Pentagon, which has to pass every year and is a perfect bill to stuff everything you want into it. But because they have broad agreement in the Senate, in the House, Republicans and Democrats, I think it will pass this year, and they will just need to find a vehicle to attach it to.
But you know, is it going to get watered down though, right? Like, because I just wonder why didn't it go through the first time unless there's a bunch of lobbyists trying to shred it?
Well, it already has been watered down. You know, it takes 72 hours to report. The clock starts when you decide as a victim when the clock starts. So it's not the ideal bill. And FBI is still objecting pretty heavily to it. We had the director of the cyber division on, Brian Vordanen, who basically is demanding a change to the law so that CISA would be required to share it with the FBI, even though DHS on our program basically committed to doing so. The FBI wants to see it in law and making sure that CISA shares everything in real time as soon as they see it. And we'll see if they get their way in Congress this year.
Sounds like a real bun fight that I'm glad I'm not a part of.
Not envious.
No. Now, we got one here. This is an NPR write-up of a report carried by a newspaper in Israel that alleges Israeli police were using NSO tools against Israeli citizens, including activists opposed to former Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, which seems like pretty big news. Now, I will say that the Israeli chief of police has said that the reporting is inaccurate. You know, they're not denying that they've used NSO software, but they're saying the stuff about not having court authorization, etc., is incorrect. But geez, I mean, Adam, this would just be yet another example of skullduggery from NSO, wouldn't it? And right in their own backyard, you just think, this is so dumb.
Yes, that's certainly the thing that would, you know, stick in everybody's craw is right there in Israel. Like, it's another thing, you know, for them when it's happening in a country that perhaps they're a little bit less worried about. But yeah, right at home has got to be a pretty big deal for them. And yeah, we don't really know. I'm not familiar with the outlet that published it, and there isn't much great sourcing in the story, so we don't, you know, know whether it's confusion or you know whether it's accurate or somewhere in between. But either way, I mean, NSO is having such a bad time already that this is just going to pile up and stick to them along with everything else. And I mean, given that the you know some of the reporting is saying they're heading towards you know even bankruptcy, right? That they're facing that much trouble from them being a you know sanctioned entity on the entity list from the US government. So yeah, definitely a bad time. But, I mean, if the story is as reported, it's pretty bad.
Yeah, it really is. And it's really dumb, too, that you wouldn't put some controls in place to prevent this from happening. Because, you know, if you wind up being used as a tool by, you know, a bent prime minister's secret police, guess what? Leaders change. And then you're in a bit of trouble. Dimitri, what did you make of all of this? And what are your thoughts on where NSO is headed generally?
Well, I do have to wonder at this point, with all the stories that have come out, was there anyone that wasn't using NSO? Maybe outside of the Five Eyes? It seems like everyone and their brother was a customer of their service. So I think we'll see a lot more of these stories coming out in the future. I know we have El Salvador coming up as well, and the hacking of journalists and activists there. But,
Well, way to ruin my segue, Dimitri, because yes, that is the next tab. Some journalists in El Salvador got hacked with NSO software. Thanks for ruining it, Dimitri. But yeah, it looks like 37 mobile devices belonging to 35 individuals. And yes, as you described, some journalists in El Salvador got done. But it's just like, what a constant drumbeat. And I'm sure they've had some wins too, right? Like, I'm sure NSO tools have been used to do some pretty righteous things. But like, you can't let this stuff happen with your software if you want to continue to trade. So I mean, that's more what I was asking about earlier, Dimitri, is what do you think of their future as a business? Because I know that they were doing bond raises, right, to fund themselves. I can't see them pulling off a successful bond raise at this point unless they attach some pretty insane rates to one.
Well, no. And once you get on the radar of the U.S. government looking at sanctions against you and so forth, you're just done as a business, in the Western world at least. So no, I think they're completely over. And particularly, the way their business model worked is that they were running the servers. They had visibility into all the victims. So you couldn't just say that, oh, we gave it to someone else and they used it and we had no idea. They had an ability to at least view it and try to constrain this activity, and they chose not to, or decided not to pay attention.
Now we've got Captain Obvious at Cyber Command releasing a bulletin. This is kind of funny. I mean, look, it's good to see. We like to encourage the US government actually making public attributions, but this one, it's like they're telling us something we already know. They have tied muddy water, drum roll please, to Iran. I know I'm shocked.
Well, I don't think it's quite as bad as you make it sound, because they actually did reveal something novel, which is they attributed to MOS, the Ministry of Intelligence in Iran, when most of the cybersecurity community thought it was an IRGC contractor, the Iranian Revolutionary Guard. So I thought that was really interesting and shows you how hard it is to do specific attribution. Attribution down to a country, Russia, China, Iran, is usually pretty easy. But once you get into specific agencies, specific parts of agencies, that's when things can get very murky. And we've seen a number of these things where people kind of got surprised by who the specific agency was. And they also released some tools, some TTPs that the Muddy Water was using. So I applaud their efforts. And I think they should be doing it a lot more often.
Yeah, agreed. So you just made me sound like a dick. Thanks a lot. Now we all love a good data drop from Chainalysis. And Kevin Collier has written this one up for NBC News. It puts a dollar figure on North Korea's cryptocurrency thefts in 2021, which is $400 million, which I did the calculations. It's about 2% of GDP. I don't think there's anything particularly surprising. If anything, I'm surprised it's not more.
Well, I think that's the point, actually, is that it's 2% of the North Korean GDP, but it's actually also 2% of the overall amount of crypto stolen last year, also according to Chainalysis, which was $14 billion. So my question is, North Koreans, why aren't you trying harder?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, I knew that's what Adam was going to say too. So.
Yeah, it's on my line as well, Dimitri. But yeah, 14 billion and they only got 400 million. Come on, they can do better than that. So much more opportunity and growth available to those North Koreans. So
yeah.
I mean, good work, good start. And also a very good reminder that every crypto bro you see is personally funding the North Korean nuclear program. So that's
maybe
nice.
we should sanction them.
Oh yeah. And that's a very good question. Why hasn't the US government sanctioned every crypto bro?
We must immediately sanction the crypto bros. What was that tweet? I retweeted it a few weeks ago, and it was a woman who posted, "Stop using the word crypto bro. It erases the presence of females, you know, in the crypto world who are equally stupid," or something like that. Equally stupid and annoying. It was very funny. And, you know, look, staying on the crypto thing, crypto.com. This is great. Great headline here. This is one from Lorenzo at Motherboard. Crypto.com says alleged $15 million hack was just a quote-unquote incident. And it looks like they're being a bit shifty, because they're saying no user funds were lost, but it looks like maybe they got popped somehow and $15 million transferred out. But they're saying, it's fine, we'll cover it. But they're not really admitting that they got owned. Like, it's all a bit difficult to parse. What did you take away from this one, Adam?
Yeah, that's exactly it. It felt weaselly, and the language, like the specifically no customer funds were lost, definitely felt like, well, so what funds were lost then? Because clearly they've lost some because the blockchain says so, thanks immutable record in the cloud. So yeah, a bit weaselly. And I mean, this is, I guess, part of the natural life cycle of any crypto exchange, right? To weasel about their stuff getting stolen, sponsor big things, put their name on stuff, buy lots of ads, and then eventually get wrecked. So yeah. I guess that's the phase that we're heading towards now.
And a lot of people making hay over the fact that crypto.com is the one that Matt Damon did a really cringeworthy ad for. And I'm so disappointed in him because he actually spends a lot of time in this part of Australia and he's quite nice by all reports. He's like a really super nice guy. And I'm like, now we're you know, the Northern Rivers region of New South Wales is very disappointed in you, Matt.
So you know, maybe it really is just an incident when it only is the cost of one Matt Damon commercial.
There you go. Mm-hmm. Now, Krebs on security. Brian Krebs is back with what I would call, you know, 24 karat Krebsing, Adam. This is, and you know, we don't even, every time we talk about one of these, it's the same, right? Which is, yes, Krebs did his usual thing, started with a thread, started pulling on it, and then doxed this guy. So yeah, he's doxed an initial access broker. And it's, you know, it's just, it's a fun read as always.
Yeah, it is very, very classic Krebsing, going after this guy called Waza Waka, who turned out to have a very long trail of, you know, online presence going back many, many years. And of course, his OPSEC back in his, you know, ICQ using days was not really up to the standard of a modern cyber criminal. And yeah, he's got domains registered to his name. And Krebs is like, and here's his sister's phone number. And I phoned her up and she didn't know anything about it, but, you know, come on. And so on and so forth. So yeah, pretty standard issue Krebs. And I'm sure, you know, he's having a bit of a rough time on the forums today. But he does say that Mother Russia will help you if you love your country. You always get away with everything, he said.
You know, who needs law enforcement? Who needs the threat intel community when you have Brian Krebs? He is amazing at uncovering these things. And, you know, doxing this guy and highlighting what he's been doing was incredible to read. But also, some really interesting nuggets in there. The guy was openly bragging about hacking Chinese companies. So to your earlier point, these guys aren't afraid to hit China in the same way that they're hitting the West. And at some point, it may come back to bite them.
Now, just a small technical piece here that I found kind of interesting, which is Chrome is building some updates in design to restrict the browser's ability to reach out to, like, you know, internal IP ranges and stuff like that. So, you know, next time you've got a website that's trying to access your router control panel, it will stop it. What do you make of this, Adam?
Yeah, this is a sensible way to address the problem. We've seen a number of stunt hacking tricks done using this kind of mechanism, like general cross-site request forgery towards internal devices like routers and so on. We've also seen some other interesting mechanisms.
Well, the one that I thought of was like fast flux DNS, you know, swapping out to local resources and things. That was cool.
Yes, that kind of dynamic DNS stuff, rapidly changing DNS. And similarly, there was some stuff with the WebRTC and the SIP tunneling that we saw used for similar sorts of things. So in general, what they've done here is bolted a control into the cause mechanism that will allow sites to authorize to request the user to authorize connections to local resources. And then they're going to turn that on in Chrome version 98 in a kind of monitoring only mode. And then eventually they'll turn it on in a later release of Chrome, because there is a surprising amount of things that do legitimately connect to local host, you know, like to local web services on your machine to bypass browser security controls. And that's, you know, pretty typical for a lot of apps that do, you know, do something that the browser can't normally do. So they need to figure out how badly it's going to break, test the UI, test the flows, all that kind of thing. But yeah, this is a sensible solution. And given how widely used Chrome is, you know, it'll solve it for, you know, a large enough portion of the user base to be genuinely useful.
Yeah, I think one thing that was interesting here, and forgive me if my reading of this is incorrect, but, you know, if a web resource is trying to, you know, a web page or something is trying to access a local resource, the browser will actually see if that resource exists before it asks the user permission. And if it doesn't exist, they're just like, no.
Yes, I think that makes sense. There's some kind of a check for that. So yeah, the actual mechanism, we'll have to see, you know, how smooth it looks. And then also the people who operate the website that's ultimately hosting the stuff will also have to have the relevant cause responses to make it all work together. And yeah, this is, it just adds an extra level of complexity that probably will be sufficient. So I think it's good.
Although this does remind me of the story you guys covered a few weeks ago about the bypass of two-factor by just that the Russians were using by just hammering people with the prompt and yeah. getting them to finally click yes. I wonder if people will adopt the same technique to bypass this feature.
It's funny you mentioned that, Dimitri, because we've got a story here that's along very similar lines. This is another one from Catalan over at The Record. And look, you know, I'm not judging the kids for hacking what they want to hack. And apparently, quote-unquote, high-profile FIFA accounts for EA, the EA FIFA game, apparently they're a very much sought after thing. And the way attackers have been able to take these over is to just keep hammering like their online support chat and keep asking them to change the email address associated with an account. And of course, you know, 99% of the support staff will say, no, you can't make that that change without providing extra information, whatever. They just keep doing it until one of them says yes, and it's been actually quite successful. Adam, what did you, I mean, this is so similar to the story we covered about, you know, the Russians just hammering people with DuoPush until they said yes.
Yeah. I mean, it's exactly the maxim we always bring up, which is it ain't dumb if it works. And yeah, just spamming support until you get someone who's making minimum wage, it just goes like click.
And the hard thing is too, how do you fix this, right? Like in the case of the push alerts, right, there is a clear fix, which is you migrate to U2F based authentication, and you know, that's gonna do a lot to solve that problem. But in this case, EA's put out a statement saying, yeah, we're gonna give our staff more training. I don't think that's gonna work.
I was gonna say, good luck with that.
Well, you know, I have to give kudos to my good friend Matt Tomlinson, who is the CISO at EA, former general manager at Microsoft, an amazing guy. I do think that he's responding the right way here. Yes, retraining is not sufficient, but he's also going to require manager approval for any change requests like that. So I think they're doing the best that they can.
Now, here's one from the Daily Swig, just a delicious little logic bug that, you know, we don't often talk about these sort of things on the show, but sometimes when they're just like such an archetypal example of a web app screw up, you know, you just sort of have to talk about them. Box Cloud Management, Box's cloud management software, there's a 2FA bypass, and it is just such a classic logic flaw. Adam, walk us through this one.
Yeah, so I pasted this article out of the news list into our work, you know, chat where all the pen testers hang out. I'm like, this is exactly the sort of bug that we are supposed to find. I hope everybody has, you know, read this and got their head around it, because like, yeah, it's such an archetypical bug in a web app flow for authentication. So this was, you log in as the user, you've got a username and password, but there's multi-factor auth. You log in with the username and password, it prompts you for SMS 2FA. You just don't go to the page that sends the actual SMS, but you get the session token for having done the first step of the multi-factor auth flow, and then you change to use the like time-based token, the TOTP token that you'd use in your, you know, Google Authenticator app or whatever else. Use that flow instead. Use your own valid TOTP, you know, authentication that you do have the relevant key material for. Enter that code, and they don't actually bind the token that you validated with to the account that you were authenticating with. So like classic using a web flow in an out of order way, or changing flows midway through, and net result is two-factor auth bypass.
Yeah.
And yeah, like because so many people integrate auth, you know, auth integration in people's web apps, you know, you have to have so many different types of auth, and it's always really fiddly and kind of site local. So people end up writing their own, and this is the sort of bugs you get when web developers have to write their own code in a really, you know, security critical place. So yeah, it's a good, such a classic bug.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. I just wanted to throw this on the case study pile because I thought it was such a good one. Yeah. And look, we're going to close it out now just with the discussion. Look, and I haven't seen this thing. I haven't played with it. I don't know anyone who has, but I just saw this and I thought, huh, that's a cool idea, which is someone has designed a sort of deliberately vulnerable API called VAPI. It's known as the Vulnerable Adversely Programmed Interface. And the idea is it's where people could go and practice hacking APIs. And I just think that's cool. We need to see this because there's so much focus on web-based stuff, and we don't see a lot really for deliberately vulnerable APIs that people can practice exploit.
Yeah, and it's a super important thing for, you know, pen testers who are covering web apps and are now having to deal with, you know, mobile apps, you know, kind of JavaScript, like React style ones, where, you know, there really is just an API being consumed by a thick client application. It just happens to be a web application. So yeah, super important for pen testers and developers to kind of understand. And yeah, we've seen how effective things like the, you know, damn vulnerable web app and all of the kind of shooting ranges and online training places have been. This also seems like a very useful thing to have a play with, you know, if you're in the testing space and you want to, you know, make sure you understand how to use the tools and find the, you know, common sorts of bugs.
Well, Adam, Dimitri, that's actually it for this week's news. Dimitri, thanks a lot for joining us and being our, you know, second co-host this week. I really enjoyed that. And Adam, I'll chat to you again next week.
Thanks a lot, Patrick. This was a lot of fun.
Thanks so much, Pat. I'll talk to you then.
That was Adam Boileau and special guest co-host Dimitri Alperovic there with a chat about the week's security news. Big thanks to both of them for that. It is time for this week's sponsor interview now with industry legend HD Moore, who's here representing his latest venture, Rumble. And just a disclosure here, I am an advisor to Rumble. Rumble is an asset discovery scanner that's pretty mind-blowing, which is what we've come to expect from tools built by HD Moore. And today we're talking to him about how Rumble quickly added features to rapidly identify assets that were impacted by the Log4Shell bug. And this includes all those assets you don't know you actually have, which is where some vuln scanners can get a little bit weak. Now, quick note, when I edited this interview this morning, I was actually having trouble keeping up. HD's brain works really fast, and when he talks, sometimes he sounds like he's auctioning cattle. So I actually digitally altered this interview, and I had to slow him down. If you'd like to restore him to full blast, set your podcast player to 1.17x, because that's the rate at which I slowed him down. Anyway, the upshot is HD and team made Rumble extremely useful for people who were looking for Log4Shell impacted software in their environment. And it's probably worth your time to just go grab a demo version so you can scan your environment to find stuff you might have missed. Anyway, here's HD Moore talking through how Rumble handled the Log4j mess.
For the Log4j issue in particular, we knew there's going to be dozens, if not hundreds, of vendors affected by it. None of the vendors had completed their analysis in the first 24 hours, let alone the first week in many cases. So it's one of those situations where even if you were blindly scanning for it by sending all the right headers with the LDAP URLs and things like that, you weren't guaranteed to find every potentially affected application because not all of them were affected by certain headers or certain variables or endpoints and so on. So doing a blind scan for those particular strings wouldn't necessarily find it everywhere. On the other half of it, which is if you actually authenticate to every machine and try to find every single copy of the Log4j jar file, you're still going to miss a lot of systems because those machines you either can't authenticate to the things like vendor appliances, virtual appliances, you know, random hardware doodads connected to your network, things like that. So it was a combination of the vendors taking a really long time to authoritatively create a list of all the affected applications, as well as the vuln response folks not really having a comprehensive way to find this thing in the wild. And so instead what happened is we put the entire team onto identifying every affected product and service out there and then helping our customers find matches for all of those services and products within their environments. So instead of saying, okay, well, you know, let's go find all your vCenter versions below this version number, we basically say, here's all your VMware vCenter across your entire enterprise. Whether it's covered by your vuln scanner or not, we already know it's here. You know, here's the IP, or here's what that device is. So it's a way for our customers to get ahead of the remediation process while the vuln scanners and everybody else kind of caught up with a response.
Yeah, and I think vuln scanners too, one thing they do rely on quite a lot, and it's just, you know, that's normal and it's not a bad thing necessarily, but they do tend to rely on software makers self-identifying bugs or at least announcing bugs in their own stuff, right? So yeah, they're not always going to have coverage of some vendor who's in your environment who doesn't actually know that they've been Log4j'd.
Yeah, absolutely. And it took a really long time for, you know, folks to identify all the different affected systems out there. We are running one list on the Rumble blog that's still probably one of the most comprehensive resources. The CISO folks put together a pretty decent list of affected apps as well, but they were missing things we had. They had stuff that we were missing early on. So it was just a big kind of jumbled mess. And of course, being over the holidays didn't really help. We did see quite a few vendors saying, hey, we're still looking into it, that didn't really have a complete list of affected products until January, which is a pretty long lag.
Yeah.
As a result, the vendors who are building, you know, vulnerability detection and other types of like patch management detection couldn't really move on this until they knew which vendors were affected by it. So it was, you know, one of those things where it was just really difficult to get a handle on all the affected products out there.
So how did you go about actually determining which products were affected and which weren't, right? Because that's a big, I know there were other people who put a lot of time into that. Kevin Beaumont, I think, was running one of his spreadsheets, right? As he's known to do. But like, what was your approach to actually trying to figure out where this thing existed?
Oh, I mean, it's community-wide. We saw a ton of great community resources. There was a public gist on GitHub that folks were contributing to that had a giant list of every affected app. The way that folks were figuring out what was affected was basically through, you know, skullduggery and either looking around the file system of deployed appliances, actually looking in the source code of different products, trying to figure out whether they used the affected libraries or not. A lot of it was coming from the vendors, but a lot of it wasn't. So it was a combination of folks just going through and finding, oh, I found your support forum where you talk about configuring Log4j in your product, therefore you must be affected, and then adding that to that list. So our team was going through and updating that list multiple times per day, then trying to come up with, you know, search queries within Rumble to say, find me everything that is running this particular product or service now that we know that it's affected, and turning into one giant query to find everything affected at once.
Now, usually in a situation like this, I imagine what would have happened is you would have had some of your customers, maybe a handful of them, would have said, okay, right, we're going to do this with Rumble, right? Like, you're going to pick your tool of choice. Some people might have said, okay, we're going to do it the Nessus way, we're going to do it this way, we're going to do it that way. Some of them would have said, okay, you know, we're all on board with your thing. That's how we're going to do it. So can you talk us through a little bit about how they actually used Rumble to do this and the sort of stuff they found that, you know, that they wouldn't have found another way?
Yeah, sure thing. I mean, vulnerability scanners are great when they know what the vulnerabilities are, when they can actually, you know, inspect the potential affected systems, when you know where their systems are in the first place. Kind of our approach with Rumble is a little bit different. Like, we're already categorizing all the software and all the products we're seeing in the network. They're already part of one big data set that's in your console within Rumble. And so for us, it wasn't a matter of going and actively running a brand new scan against the network. It was just a matter of finding all the different services, products, and devices through different search queries and say, hey, this is the VMware vCenter, or this is that type of product, and so on. So it's a question of helping our customers build out those queries and then using that to create a short list for remediation, or if not remediation, at least monitoring.
Yeah. So how did you prioritize, right? Because that's the hard part, because it affected so many different things. I'd imagine some of them, though, like you might have decent egress filtering on this, you know, box over here. So you're like, well, you know, that's going to be a bit fiddly. We can maybe not worry about that one quite so much. But what were the showstoppers? What were the ones where it's like, oh my God, you know, we need to get on top of that?
The ones we're most concerned about are ones that are intentionally exposed outside the firewall. So, yeah, you know, jump machines like VMware Horizon, for example, that's a type of system that's supposed to be exposed externally because that's how your users actually get to it.
I hear, though, that mostly that one was being used for lateral movement. Like, why am I hearing that?
That was interesting because if you can use that to get to the vCenter, and if from the vCenter you can get to the SAML cert, you can basically mint your own credentials to anything. And once you commit your you basically take over the entire infrastructure. Like, you own all virtual infrastructure at that point.
Okay, so that makes sense. So there'd be some people who are running it internally, and once you get that, then you've got, SAML, right? So you've got all of their SAML. That makes sense. But some people are exposing this stuff externally.
Yeah, so the number one priority for us is what products are being exposed externally by design, and then making sure we had coverage for those products first. So, you know, VPN devices, any kind of external file sharing products, for example, anything that otherwise would normally be externally exposed. And then as we kind of work down that list, the next biggest one would be, okay, what products are not necessarily exposed externally, but are the most widely deployed across most environments? Which ones are almost certainly going to be accidentally exposed or going to be reachable by the majority of users within an organization? So things like your Jira ticket backends, all the Atlassian products, stuff like that, those are pretty high on that list. And then we kind of work down everything else.
So was it the case that you just wound up building a view essentially for your customers where if they just click the show me everything in my environment that is Log4j vulnerable, it would spit out a list?
Yep, you got it. We updated that list continuously for about 2 weeks straight. So
yeah,
it was, there's a lot of churn. The really tough thing about Log4j was that no one knew it was affected on day one. And once the first patch came out, a lot of vendors who were on top of things said, great, we've updated to the new version of Log4j. We're great. We're going on holiday. See you. Goodbye. And then the next bug came out, then the next bug came out, the next bug came out, and those products stopped getting updated. So in a lot of cases, folks thought they did the remediation for a given product on the first day or the second day, and then they realized they had to do it all over again, and then do it all over again every couple of days all the way to, you know, early this year. So it became really difficult for folks to get ahead of it because it wasn't just a one and done kind of fix per product. It was this constant rolling wave of updates and remediation that folks had to do. And the vendors oftentimes had already put their staff in vacation, had already done change control freezes for the year. It was just a really difficult time to be able to respond quickly to it.
Let me ask you this. In the view of assets, if you're just randomly scrolling assets as they appear in your Rumble console, could you do something like add a poop emoji to the ones that have Log4j? Because that'd be cool.
You certainly could. You could only use the search query we have today to add a tag, and one of the tag values could obviously be whatever emoji you want. So it's doable.
Okay. Yeah. Well, just a feature suggestion from my end there. So how quickly did you actually have like a decent how quickly do you think, in your estimation, did your customers actually wind up with decent visibility using this approach, right? And look, I'm not just trying to, you know, kiss ass here. I'm just more interested because this isn't the normal way that we do this, right? The normal way that we would do this is a combination of using tools like Web App Scanner, say NetSpark or whatever, and, you know, you're going to use your Nessus. You might be using some Canaries and doing it a bit of a homebrew way. I'm just really curious to see how this, you know, network asset enumeration approach worked out and how quickly you were able to give people decent coverage. How long would you say it was before you were able to offer your customers something approaching decent coverage?
We mostly heard about the bug the Thursday or Wednesday or Thursday before when it started being used on Minecraft servers. By Friday morning, kind of the week before, it really got set on fire. A lot of folks really started making noise about it. And then through the weekend, we started working on our query set. So by Monday morning, we'd already reassigned the entire development team to just work on Log4j for the foreseeable future for the rest of the year, basically. And we started getting queries out and updating them, you know, hourly, and then doing really big updates every day. I wouldn't want to say for the first batch, like externally exposed applications and appliances, we had some pretty solid queries within 24 hours. Probably by late Monday afternoon, we had a pretty solid set for a lot of our customers for external facing stuff. And then we had a pretty comprehensive view of everything affected by the end of the first week. And we kept that rolling forward into the new year. And even still, we're making updates to it.
Because it's a bit of a special case, right? Because when I think about this, the rapid response use case for Rumble isn't this. It's not you identifying what's vulnerable. The rapid response use case is more like you hear that there's a terrible bug affecting a commonly deployed enterprise thing, and then you check Rumble to see if you have it. So that's the rapid response use case. But in this case, you're clearly playing a different role, which is more the role of a vuln scanning company. Like, is this something you're going to do more of, or is this more a case of like, well, this is a big deal and we're in a good position to help, so we're going to help?
In this case, it's just like, we knew the vuln management folks were going to take a while to get out of it. We knew the vendors are still having trouble responding. So we were like, you know, our customers were asking us for help on it. We decided this is the most important thing we could be working on, scratch the rest of our development cycle and focus on that. But you're right, though. Usually what happens is someone says, okay, this new vulnerability affects Exchange. Where are my Exchange servers? Let me go check Rumble real quick. Because you don't have to worry about your vulnerability management system getting an update for a new vuln check, right? Where in that case, you're really just looking for, where is this affected technology or product anywhere in my environment first. So we excel kind of at that part, which is finding, you know, every instance of your technology. The hard thing about Log4j is that oftentimes we didn't have existing fingerprints for the given product or service. So instead, we had to build search queries on the fly that found those products, looking for things like web page titles, fav icons, little snippets of text from the login page, other banners that represent that particular service or that indicate that vulnerable service is on the same machine. So we ended up using kind of a combination of queries that touched every aspect of the data that Rumble collects, not just, you know, product or service name.
How useful is a free trial of Rumble going to be in a large environment? Like, because I'd imagine there's people listening to this who might just want to grab Rumble and just, you know, they've been through their Log4j remediation and stuff, but they've heard you talk just now and they're thinking, yeah, maybe I want to just have a quick look with Rumble to see if we missed anything. Is that something you're able to do with a trial version, or it depends on the size of the network?
Oh, yeah, of course. Our trial doesn't have any real caps on it. If you do need more than like 50,000 assets, we can bump that up for you real quick. Our free tier covers up to 256 devices, which more than covers most small businesses and home users, of course, home labs. And that's free to use and we don't charge anything for it. But yeah, for enterprise trials, feel free to get up and running with the free trial of the website. You don't have to talk to a salesperson to get up and running. It's all self-serve. If you have any questions, you reach out to the support team. The support team is myself, the rest of engineers. You know, whoever you talk to, you knows how to respond to whatever the issue is. So we take a lot of pride in the fact that we have engineering handling our support.
All right, HD Moore, thanks a lot for joining us to talk through, your response. You guys wading into Log4j and being useful when it was not your place to be useful. We love to see it. Thanks. Thanks for the chat.
Thanks, Matt. Appreciate it.
That was HD Moore there talking all things Rumble. You can find Rumble at rumble.run. And, I am a true believer in Rumble. And, I hope you all check it out. Maybe just grab a copy and see what you missed. Anyway, that is it for this week's show. I do hope you've enjoyed it. I'll be back next week with more security news and analysis. But until then, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.